This is the theme of Parshat HaChodesh, Tav Shinayin Aleph, which occurs in Parshat Tazria, which both of which, of course, are linked to the very simple nature of Ibur, so that the moon and the Lashon of Leda here, which opens up our sugya of Tzaras, are powerfully linked. And it turns out that that link has to do with Adam's unique ability to deal with the most complex of systems, which remarkably are the most local of systems, are the development of life, the type of astronomical issues that don't have simple algorithms, the things about which Darwin pointed out are those things that have a grandeur. Because of the very fact that they're local, allows for a level of complexity that is far greater than anything else in the universe. It's Adam who provides the amazing link to information of that level, who is nonetheless capable of simplifying and living within a world as if at play, at the very time that he continues his quest for an understanding of self, an understanding of universe, and an attempt to connect all of that through Torah, through Tefillah, to the simulator himself, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And this is the thesis of the Tazria and Parshat HaChodesh, Parshiot that came out in Tav Shinayin Aleph. So we examined the interrelationship of first of Leda and Tzarat in terms of the development of information, and the miscarriage of information, and the way in which that relates to the information of Lashon Hara that provides for, as the Rambam puts it, the common denominator in the multiple usages of Tzarat, showed how that itself relates to the Ibur of the moon, which was part of Parshat HaChodesh, then came to see as both those parshiot, despite the fact that they are very simplified in terms of how we deal with it, by making it a mola, that is an emtsai, by making it kazera evakadesh, by taking tzarat, which is so complex, and seeing it as l'chol mar'ei einei ha'kohen, to the point where the kohen doesn't even have to understand the complexity. Somebody else can be telling him what is really going on over here, and he's allowed to say what he needs to say on that basis. And we saw this in the end as being actually an expression of that which is so unique about the human condition, in which it is capable of taking the complexity that Darwin termed as the grandeur of this view in life, recognizing that complexity not only at the level of biological systems and their emergent properties, which are hopelessly complex, but even a unique complexity in local astronomical phenomena, which is the Earth-Moon system that is so special in the, at least the universe as we know it so far. And that it's specifically there, and that Adam actually turns out to be the linkage between the complexity, which is always, as Newton said, like a child playing on a seashore, discovering little bits here and there, but in the presence of a vast sea of knowledge that we barely touch. And the same Adam that recognizes that he's on a constant quest to recognize and to understand and to make full experiential use of the days that are his in understanding himself, his presence in the universe, and to experience what it means to exist as an Adam. This is the only thing that is capable, essentially, of sending a signal out of a simulation in which, for the first moment, you have real significant data, not information on the level of something that makes a difference, which is enough for quantum evolution, but information as it is seen by a consciousness that views it as significant, which is a completely different order of information, just as consciousness is a completely different order of complexity. And there you have the Adam as the mitpalel, the Adam as the makir, the Adam as the miyached, the Adam that changes the entropic condition of an eid yala min ha'aretz into the actual presence of a shechita, which is the meaning of relationship, expressed in a very non-entropic onan. And it is there that we discover ourselves and the experience of our own confused lives. This is the review shiur on Parshat Tazria, which was also Parshat HaChodesh, Shnat Tav Shin Ayin Aleph. And we do our regular thing. so that we have to go through some of the issues, even though they've been written, and even though we've been discussing, we discuss them often. And that is pointing out that the sugya that opens the parsha and gives it its name, which is called Tazria, is on the surface irrelevant to the whole story, because it's just sort of a brief non sequitur when we're talking about birth. What does birth have to do with anything? I mean, actually, we move off from birth right away. There are a few issues that are non sequiturs. We go through the birth issue and then the the question of the Brit Milah in the middle of all of this, which is really not part of anything that we're dealing with here, at least one would think. But then we move on to the real meat of the issue, which is the meat, the basar, kiyeh, the orbisaro. The meat of the issue is negoyim. And this runs through not only this week's parsha, next week's parsha, Parshat Mitzrayim, but remarkably, Parshat Mitzrayim ends with the same issues with which it begins. Not with birth per se, but with the other elements that are nogei of birth. So we talk about zivot, we talk about nidot, we talk about zav, we talk about keri, all of which relate remarkably, not to birth, but to the opening word, which is zri'ah, ishaki tazri'ah, which is a second order irrelevancy. I mean, if we want to talk about the din of birth, it's really not our business to worry about the issues of what goes into making that birth happen. As the Zohar points out, I mean, why are we talking about Kitazria? Obviously, if she had a baby, then somewhere other there needed to be conception, but that's not part of the story, is it? So it should just say Isha Kitelet. What's this Isha Kitazria V'yalda? And yet, if you take a look at the end of the duet here, that's exactly what it's about. Only about these things. And of course, that issue in and of itself is, I mean, remarkably nogea, the other question of the parsha, which is its relationship to Parshat HaChodesh, which here it's matched up to in a leap year. Because, of course, Parshat HaChodesh, Ishati Tazria, the whole idea of the moon, is referred to as Ibur. So that you have the Chodshei HaIbur, the Bechol Iburei, we're going to talk about this in detail a little bit later, but the way in which HaKadosh Baruch Hu relates to us is Kufat HaIbur, as the Gemara Brachot points out. That's the essence of Tvila, in terms of a Tvila Ktsara. Ki Isha Ubra. Again, there's a strange interrelationship, and we're going to have to get to understand it. But as far as this Tzarat is concerned, the truth is that we have the Losh of the Rambam here, that Tzarat is itself confusing, because the word is not clear. We talk about Tzarat in terms of Negoyim, as if it's a particular syndrome. But as the Rambam points out, it isn't really a particularized syndrome, because, and he points this out strangely twice, making a great a highlight on the fact that the word Tzarat doesn't really seem to make any sense as a particular definition. And what he says is this, Hatzarat hu shem ha'amur b'shutafut. This is a word that is used as a reference that is mixed. So it's b'shutafut for many different issues. We're talking about things that are different, and yet seem to have evolved a set, all of which is called Tzarat, despite the fact that it's not clear what the common denominator is of that set. Because ein domim zelazeh, they're not really similar to each other. I mean, think about the various things that we talk about over here. On the one hand, you have loven or ha'adam, but a change in coloration of skin, which is called tzarat. You have nefila of ktsat siyar harosh, or hazakan, it's called tzarat, because that's the Rambam Shita, and how to define netek, that's machloket rishonim. Shinui in habigadim, or abatim, coloration changes in clothing, or in homes, is called tzarat. Vizeha shinui, now this change, which ha'amur b'begadim abatim, which is mentioned in terms of clothing or housing, and here he repeats, Shekarato Torah Tzarat B'shutafut Hashem, which is only called Tzarat as a borrowed term, so to speak, a name for a set. Eino mimin hago shel olam, It's not something that you would say is part of normal nature, although we're going to be medayik those words minago shel olam later. Ela ot v'pele, an absolutely strange type of near miraculous occurrence, a wondrous thing that would occur in Yisrael, kedei lahaziran mi lashon hara. Then he goes through the entire discussion of the nature of lashon hara, how it is integrated with this concept of tzara'at. So, I mean, the truth is, of course, that the issue of tzara'at and the way in which it really, strangely, is connected to the idea of lashon hara, we pointed out is that this is true even in terms of the Latin, in which we use it in English. So we talk about maligning, which is directly related to malignancy. It comes from exactly the same word. And it all relates back to malgenesis, which goes back to the story of the Nachash, who is viewed as the model of Nega, the Or HaNachash. He's viewed as the model of Lashon Hara, so that he's the one that actually introduces Ra through the external violation of the real meaning of the information by presenting in a particular context. That's viewed as Lashon Hara. And, amazingly, he is also viewed as the core of the concept of Mila. Because essentially, as the Zohar points out in this week's parsha, which we'll get back to, but the idea of Mila is turning a serpent, which is the penis, is basically the phallus, which is reptilian, and turning it through the act of Mila into something human, which then the orla, the foreskin, is bedavka put into dirt. Those are makbed on that. Most people are makbed on that at the Brit Milah, because ha'afar anachash afar lachmo. So that we recognize that we're dealing with the reptilian vision back from Gan Eden itself, and that means that all of the issues that are mentioned here, as pointed out in the Tanna de Eliyahu, I think that's actually, I forgot to bring that source, maybe a Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, are all issues from Gan Eden, because the klolot that were given in Gan Eden included Ziva, Zav, Keri, Tsar Leda, and these issues of Negoyim. So it means that everything here is a reference back to Genesis, maligning in terms of Lashon, Mila, Leda with its concurrent pathologies, which includes all of the other issues that are mentioned here. Remarkable. And Begadim, the dinner of the Begadim, needing to make a place for yourself in the world. So that we understand that the connection, certainly on the obvious level of the flow, takes the Chatat Nachshon, which is the reference to dealing on Yom HaShmini B'miluim. This becomes the Shmini, that's Nogea, the Taharat HaMetzorah, in which we redo everything that we did on Shmini L'miluim. The only other time we did this. You take blood, you put it on the nose, on the ears, and on the toes, and on the thumb. And the only other time we do that, blood and oil, is by the Metzorah. This is Yom HaShmini, this is Yom HaShmini. What's brought on Yom HaShmini was the beginning of the Chatot of the Nesiim, Chatot Nachshon, which is basically on the Nochash, because that's the sign of a Chatot that has not been brought for a particular sin of an individual, but on the nature of sin, which is the Chatot HaYoledet, as the Gemara points out. In other words, there's no sin that's involved, but rather we're referring back to this idea of original sin, the possibility of sin, the potential of Da'at, and that goes back to the Yom HaShmini. Again. Now, the immediate suggestion, therefore, of what the Rambam is pointing out, which was not the Rambam's Kiddush, it's the Gemara that brings this all out, even in terms of the word Mitzorah, that the word Mitzorah is Motzi Shem Ra, that the interrelationship over here at a very profound level is the nature of the translation of information. The misuse of information is basically what is coming out in the story of Leda versus Tzara'at and all of these malignancies. Because what we become aware of is the fact, and this is something that Moshe Rabbeinu points out himself, when he sees his sister affected by Tzara'at. So what he says is, and this is an instant response. He asks God, he says, Al natahi kamet asher b'tzeto mirechem imo, in the world. In other words, Yitziyah min Arechem, which is Leda, relates to malignancy in the newborn. That's what he's talking about Miriam. So in other words, the contradiction here is viewed by him as the contradiction between the normal processes of the translation of the information of DNA into an actual Leda, versus the mutations that are involved in malignancy, in which imagine, says Moshe Rabbeinu, at the instant of birth, to see a newborn half-eaten alive with malignancy. That is the horror of what we're talking about, all put into one. So it means the nature of chet as it affects Lida is actually an insight into the potential for misinformation, which is the nature of tzaraas, not only of tzaraas, but of motzi shemra, so that the sugyas actually interrelated very profound ways, not only back to Gan Eden, but in the actual way in which we experience the translation of information in the world. So whether we're talking about information as I speak it, we're talking about information in terms of the subtle relationships between cells or between proteins in the expression that ultimately leads to cellular formation. We're talking about the same problem, which, as the Medrash so unbelievably puts it, what are Negayim for? What causes Negayim to come? Hanichnas b'tchum she'eno shelo. You enter into an area that is not your own. And that, of course, is the nature of malignancy. So that you invade instead of as a liver cell, you invade and you start growing as an undifferentiated cell within a liver, within a lung, within wherever it is, and destroy whatever is there. That breaking into a tchum she'eno shelcha and believing that you are the generic and therefore incorporate all possibilities destroys all differentiation. It's an astonishing thing that the Torah should put all of these things together. It's absolutely amazing. And yet, what's interesting is that for all of the complexity that we discuss over here, as the Rambam seems to be pointing out, the end result is a simplification, seems to border on the oversimplification. And this is not only true when it comes to the issue of the main point here, which is the relationship of Leda Nega, but also to the additional Kriya that we had, which was the Kriya Parashat HaChodesh. Because there too, we very, very much oversimplify. Why do we oversimplify? Really, because we have no choice but to oversimplify. Newton oversimplified for a very simple reason. As the Gemara puts it, Shemesh Yada Mevo'ol. Shemesh Yada Mevo'ol means the sun seems to know where it's going. Why do we say that? Because it takes a simple algorithm for us to be able to read out all of the eclipses that will be for eternity. And so it's very simple. Why is it simple? Because we're able to simplify. The difference between the mass of the sun and the mass of the earth and the distance between them means that for all intents and purposes, we can take Newton's simplification of viewing gravity as being in the center of an object as being absolutely the description of the earth's orbit around the sun, because for all intents and purposes, the fact that the center of gravity is displaced by 1 yard, 1 meter at the center of the sun is irrelevant. However, when it comes to the Earth-Moon system, there you run into terrible problems because of the fact that simplification doesn't work. The reason it doesn't work is that the Moon is so absurdly large, and I say absurdly because it is not duplicated anywhere that we know of. It's not duplicated, obviously not in our own solar system, but I mean, to this point, there's nearly 1,000 exoplanets that have been examined. Not one of them exhibits the type of relationships of an Earth-Moon system. It's a satellite that cannot form by normal circumstances, simply because you don't have an initial aggregation of material. You can't have two centers of gravity that are so close to each other. The only way such a thing could possibly have formed is by collision. And the likelihood of something happening like that without busting up both bodies and so on is very, very small. And it's a complex type of interrelationship that forms that particular system, which has all types of implications, by the way, for the development of complex life. Because it's only the fact that there's an Earth-Moon system that keeps the Earth from really turning on its side, which is what happens to planets that aren't that. So you have that complete mix-up of seasons, days, and nights over time, which precludes the development of complexity. You have to have these constant migrations and so on. It's very, very, very difficult to have the circumstances that are necessary. But even without that, in terms of a simple gravitational analysis, the Earth and the Moon represent a single system. It's not that the Moon orbits the Earth. You can't approximate the Moon orbiting the Earth. That's the problem, because they both orbit around a very displaced from the center of the Earth, center of gravity, which means that until today, there's no single algorithm that will yield you all of the information that you want about the Earth-Moon system. If you want to get all of the possible kinds of eclipses that are going to happen, you're going to have to use a lot of different algorithms to see how they work out, because it's simply too complex to have one simple readout. If you get on the internet, you try to get an algorithm, there's a lot of different possibilities, and each one has its advantage, but none of them are going to be completely accurate. So it's all really approximation. It's an approximation. Stop, please. It's an approximation that actually comes to the fore in the Gemara in very funny ways, which, you know, which we spoke about. One curious maisa was that based on this, Shemesh Yadam Mevo'o, Yoreach Lo Yadam Mevo'o, basically. So yeah, there was a problem that Rabbi Chiya had, where he sees the moon at the wrong time, according to his cheshbon. So he takes a clod of earth and he throws it and says, "You get the heck out of here. I mean, we're supposed to be Makadosh you tonight. You're not supposed to be here. Akayam Tafi. Zil Ichsi. Go cover yourself. Get out of here, please." So it doesn't work out with our calculation. You know? So what we do is we simplify. And we simplify in the same way, interestingly enough. In both situations, we simplify by saying, L'chol mar'eh enei ha-kohen. And there we say, Kazeh re'eh v'kadesh. Achodesh hazeh l'achem, kazeh re'eh v'kadesh. In both cases, it's dependent on the interpretation rather than on the reality. So when it comes to l'chol mar'eh enei ha-kohen, so first of all, if the bayit doesn't have a window, don't turn on the light. If the individual has a nega in an area that wouldn't have been exposed in a normal Gan Eden setting, specifically post-height. So the way that we would measure, we would have a man stand working on hoeing the earth. Of course, this is Kalola in Gan Eden. So if standing naked in that fashion, the nega wouldn't be visible. We don't do an intimate, minute examination, so I don't see any nega. For a woman, of course, we take her problem. Nursing. So we see the woman nursing. If the nega is visible, fine. If it's not visible, we're not going to lift folds of skin to see whether there's a nega in there. Same exact situation. When it comes to the moon, we darshan exactly the same words. Chodesh is a lachem, lachem, afilu shogigin, afilu mutayin. Doesn't matter. I just want to make some lists of chorus that I forget. So on the one hand, we have two related here complex systems that the Torah seems to have gone out of its way to actually simplify. And yet, on the other hand, there is something that runs counter to the idea of simplification in that there is a common denominator of exposure. And when I say exposure, there's a beautiful medrash that brings this out in a lovely, lovely way. The pasuk in Shir HaShirim talks about the Taltalim Shechorot. So what exactly is Taltalim Shechorot? Well, there's two explanations. We say HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Taltalim Shechorot Chorev. I mean, Orev is not usually the way we look at beauty. You know, Orev is usually the opposite of Klal Yisrael. No, it's the crow, the raven. And the raven is always the symbol of the antithesis. It's the Arab, Arov, Arev. That which is Mu'urav, it's Ta'arovet. I mean, it's not something that we would use as a mushal for. It's the exact opposite of Ivri as opposed to Aravi. It's also the same idea. We always look at that as problematic, not as something that is a solution. So why would it say Shecharot Ke'orev? Is bothered. What's that?
Erev
also. It's a time at which you lose clarity. Ta'arovis is a loss of clarity. Whereas the Ivri makes a stand. Everything else can be that, but this is the reality. It's the exact opposite. Why would you say Shecharot Ke'orev? So there's two explanations. One is Shecharot Ke'orev means that Talmidei Chachamim look in this world pretty bad. Because they don't take care of themselves. They don't make money. They live in poor conditions. So they're nearing Ke'urim. They're nearing Shechorim B'olam Hazeh. Therefore, it's coming to tell you, La'atid Lavo, as it says in Nachum, Marihem Kelapidim, Givrakim, Yirotzatzu. Fine. It's one explanation. Reb Shmuel Bar Yitzchak says, no, this is talking about the Torah itself, which is the Pashtus of the Lashon and the Pasuk. It's talking about the Parshiot HaTorah. In what sense are they Shechorot Ke'orev? The Torah has a lot of Parshiot that are really dark. I mean, you would think that these things are too ugly. They're Ke'urot. They're too ugly to discuss in public. You need to talk in public about Nidais and Zivais and Keri and Why would we discuss this in Perek, in public? Omar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, ke'orev means arevot. B'shechorot, you say they're dark. I say they are sweet. I like this. V'orval Hashem minchat Yudav Yerushalayim. And I'll prove it to you. Teda l'chashuke. Here you have a parsha of Zov, parsha of Zov. The Torah was interested in not discussing things that you find disgusting. Couldn't it put together the two parshas of Zov, Zov? I mean, you could figure out. It means, we have to say respectively, reproductive fluids, whatever the heck it is, right? But no. Lo nemru shtem kecha. Zov b'fnei atzma. Zov b'fnei atzma. Ish ish ki yazov mi besaro. V'isha ki yazov. I mean, it seems the Torah like doesn't even want to be mitzantzim discussing this. Anu rabba, the more the merrier. There's your proof to the very nature of the discussion, in a sense, is uncovering. It's forcing you to an awareness of a willingness to address the issue. Double meaning. But not only address the issue in that sense, but also the idea of touching on the makorot of evil, or even the Gemara about Bisurahi Lahem, which also I forgot to include. The Bisurahi Lahem is that it uncovers the hidden things that the Kananim had, or it uncovers Asher Lo Habayi, the guy who claimed, I don't have a lawnmower to lend you, and now he has to take all the things out of his house, and whoops, there's a lawnmower. Well, so this was the Mitzorah, the Ayin Hara, somebody who was, Ayin was Ra to lend out his things. And of course we have the Zohar's understanding of it, that it exposes the nature of Avodah Zorah, or evil, that was embedded in these homes. The exposure of the various issues of Tuma that we have here. As Rashi says, I forgot all of these to write them down. The Tzarat Mam Eret, he means that, look, things may look good on the surface here, you know, but what the Kohen has to recognize is that this is a sign of a covering over of some very serious pathology that's going on under the surface, and therefore what you're looking at is something that is going to burst out and is going to be horrific, and, you know, it just looks nice, which, of course, is the idea of plastering the house. We even use that in modern Hebrew. Al tatiach, don't plaster it over. So plastering something over means you're trying to hide a problem that lies beneath the surface. It then comes out, which of course is what happens here in the Tzarat HaBatim. You plaster it, and there it is a week later, and it's made its way out to the surface again. That same thing is Tzarat Noshenet. The Tzarat Noshenet is that it's still there, and it breaks out. And it's that breakout, which even today, that would be the worst possible sign if after having put the cancer into remission, it's suddenly back again. You know you're in serious trouble. I'm going to do a little bit of a pen. But I won't talk because, you know, Rav Moshe doesn't want me to talk when we repent. But I'll use the time to take a drink. Taltalim Shecharot. Yes, why don't you focus right here? We've got our Taltalim Shecharot. Yeah, there we go. There we go. There we go. Very nice. Yeah.
You know, I was here for some reason or another.
I can imagine we can even use you for better than that. We have the Ishaki Tazria, as the Gemara says, this exposes the actual intercourse that led to this conception, because it shows us who was Mazria Tehila, Isha Mazra Tehila, Yoledet Zakar, or according to the Zohar, it exposes the depth of desire, which is why it's talking about Ishaki Tazria, who all along was driven by this desire to have this child. Of course, this is the exposure of Lashon Hara, where the essence, as the Gemara calls it, Maaseh Hashai, something that you do in private, where you think nobody is listening. That's the way in which the Gemara says, Me'olam lo amarti davar v'chazarti l'achora. I never said anything where I had to look behind me to see who's listening. If I said it, it's something that I would say in public where everybody can hear. Therefore, by definition, I'm not hiding anything. It's wholesome. It's straightforward. And that's the problem. That's the Ketoret, which is Maaseh Hashoy, that's Bechaper, on Lashon Hara, which, of course, goes right back to the union of Nega, which is the violation of the Kuhuna, which goes us all the way back to the Kuhuna that is defined by the Ketoret, and for attempting to bring the Ketoret, you get Nega. This is what happened with Uziyahu. So it goes back to the relationship of Yom HaShmini to this din of the Tzorat itself. The nature of Lashon Hara, as the Gemara puts it. Yeah, you sit together and you talk together at a cocktail party, you know, ochlim v'shotim zeim zeh. But under the surface, medakrim zeh tzeh b'charavot shebilashonam. Perfect description of modern society. You know, let's see who can get in some other nasty comment while pretending that everything is nice on the surface. So If, in fact, the Torah is insisting that we're meant to uncover and deal with issues in the way the Zohar puts this, is very, very beautiful here in this parsha. That's actually the Raya Mehemna. So the fact that of our, we spoke about before, our minhag to put the foreskin into Ofer, it's the Zohar that's the mocker of that minhag. And it brings out that that's why at the time, Bahuzimna, the Miskanji, Amakadisha, to take off the Orla because of the Brit, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Machnes, his entire Bamal Yeshele, and shows them the value that these people have in making themselves human. Vilahu Orla, and after removing the foreskin, you prepare Metakli Monachara Ba'afra, you prepare a bowl full of dirt. Because you need to put Lashra Orla Begabe, you need to put the Orla into that. And this is, as it says, of the Nachash Afar Lachmo, Afar Tochal Koyimei Chayecha, as it says in Bereshit. The Nachash Afar Lachmo is from Yeshayahu. And therefore, it says the Raya Mehemna, an amazing thing. Mikant lo itztarech lanhaga kalana bahu atar. You have to be very careful not to deal with this issue as if it's an element of kalon. Kalon would be the closest word, maybe we would use scandal, as if it's scandalous, which is scandalous, which is the way a Victorian would talk about sexual issues. Do not deal with this issue. Be kalon, even though afagav the ma'avir lemikami hybrid, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu, bedafka gives the nachash, it's offer b'chol mokam. So how can you pretend that this is unimportant? It has to be important to you. So then that means that these issues, this ties in directly to the Shechorot Ke'orev. Although we pretend to be simplifying, in fact, the nature of the entire Parsha is to deal with issues in which polite society, they supposedly don't exist. This is bedafka what Chazal have done, not only utilizing Brit Mila as Shminit, which is the idea of our self, our creating of ourselves, but they turned all inyanim of refuah into shmini. And in that refuah include the most amazing thing of going to the bathroom. So that golui v'yadu, we say, we talk about the bria of Adam. Asher yatzarata, same thing we say at the chasana, you understand. Asher yatzarata Adam, wow, yotzer Adam. Over here, what's the yotzer Adam? Nikavim, Nikavim, Chalulim, Chalulim. Remember the first chasana that I saw. My grandparents took me to chasana. My principal was in school, and he was probably 7 years old at the time. And it was the first time I heard his brachas. The guy gets up there and he starts to say, Yatzarat Adam. I tug on my grandma and said, what are you, just go to the bathroom? Exactly what's going on here. Back to Gemara, said, what's going on? Now, this is where we talk about Kisei Kvodecha, where you go to the Beta Kisei. That's the only time we mention Kisei Kvodecha. It's all strange. So the Adam becomes full of Nikavim, Nikavim. Chalulim, Chalulim. But that's exactly, we're talking about normal processes, you understand? The relation of this normal process to Rofecho Basaru Mavlila Asot is exactly the same as the relationship of Leida to Tzarat. What are we talking about? I mean, you're just going to the bathroom. What do you mean, just going to the bathroom? What are you, crazy? Just going to the bathroom? You run into the situation where you can't go to the bathroom. Chas v'shalom, there's something is broken down in your kidneys and you can't urinate. Or even simple problems in your bladder. For God's sake, you won't say just go to the bathroom. You'll understand that you're talking about some of the most complex issues in the world. But the processing that's going on between the liver and the kidneys and the purification and the fact that your ocean that you carry around with you requires an entire mechanism of being able to maintain your life. And it's wild. That's not just. Oh, it's just a baby. Just a baby. With billions and billions of cellular replications to create that infant from the first simple the creation of something that's undifferentiated and no mistakes? You gotta be kidding. How's that possible? So it's astonishing, of course. Rofecho basar umaf lilasot. Astounding. Okay, then this supposed simplification is actually not all that simplified. Adarabha, we're being asked to look specifically to these things. Now, it cannot be coincidental that these two issues have a very special relationship in terms of complexity to the universe as a whole.
One of them, which is the translation of biological information, is, as Darwin pointed out so beautifully, you have the lesson on your phone, is his famous conclusion to the description of the nature of natural selection, which is there's grandeur in this view of life. And the grandeur is that if people generally look down at the biological sciences as being a bit less well-defined than physics. I mean, they're all built on contingent events, on particular histories that took place. And if you contrast them with, if you're having a rough time, I'll just...
I sent maybe a link. I didn't really know it was in the Shear. It's a link to a website.
Oh, no. I need it in the Shear itself. Yeah.
Right.
Right. So then, beep. Just want to get the exact language. Beep.
No, I pulled it up with too many options.
It's funny, actually, because that's
exactly... I meant to put it into the notes.
There's a good joke on this.
There is grandeur in this view of life with its several powers having been originally breathed into a few forms or into one.
Oh, then I have to open it up, because that's just what's quoted by...
No, I need the latter. The whole creationist big problem is that in the popular versions of Darwin, it says having been breathed by the Creator because he gave in to the political and he changed it for the later editions. This is the lush of the original edition.
He edited out,
exactly. So, there is a grandeur in this view of life with its several powers. Having been originally breathed, here they are, by the Creator, which is not the first edition, into a few forms or into one, and that whilst this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed law of gravity, and therefore basically nothing ever happens, just goes cycling on, from so simple a beginning, endless forms.
Button on top.
I thought it was only my phone, all the androids do this. Endless forms. And most beautiful and most wonderful have been and are being evolved. So that's the point. I mean, he had no concept at the time of the true level of complexity he was talking about in mathematical terms. He just recognized that, look, physics is boring. Astronomy is boring. Things just go on cycling along according to fixed laws of gravity. I mean, that's, what's the big deal? But as it becomes more and more evident to us what we're talking about in terms of orders of complexity, it's almost laughable to say there's just grandeur in this view of life, that the difference is only in the fact that over here you have new things happening, and according to the fixed laws you have no new things happening. It's much, much more than that. It's that the order of complexity and the nature of what you're dealing with is so many orders above the simple fact of the interrelationship of silly little things like quasars and galaxies and black holes and so on, which are, the mathematics is relatively simple. When you're dealing with, again, as we've pointed out so many times, you're dealing with something on the level of complexity of the interrelationship of neurons, or groups of neurons, not even neurons, not individual, but groups of neurons with particularized functions in the human brain. I mean, you're talking about orders of complexity that are 10 to the trillionth of powers, not the trillionth of times, trillionth of powers, which is simply not something that we can grasp at all, far beyond the number of actual particles there are in the universe. And that's crazy. So this is like a small insight into what you're talking about, complexity. And of course, the other thing that what he was saying, which is the fixed laws of gravity, the one place where there aren't laws of gravity is the moon, as we pointed out before. These are the two issues which locally we can deal with. So that on the one hand, we look at it as sort of silly. I mean, what's the big deal, So you have a rock, nice, okay. I mean, take that moon and take it out of the poetry and put it into its simple astronomical form, So you've got a large satellite, and big deal. What is it? Maybe it's a radio transmitter from some other, I don't know, who cares? Does it really matter? And yet, the fact that we need to deal with this in this uniquely local way, the same way that we deal with life in a uniquely local way, is remarkably in the area in which the grandeur lies, not where it's violated. And we'll see that this ends up being an actual remarkably important issue, so that when it comes to our relationship, the interrelationship between these two issues is immense, because the importance of that satellite cannot be overestimated, both in terms of its presence that allowed for the evolution of the complexity that we see, and of course, remarkably, for the impact that it's had on the experience of our own complexity. Particularly, remarkably, as everybody knows, and that's the reason the Gemara talks about it in this fashion, particularly in terms of birth. The menses are linked directly to the moon, linked directly to the evolution of life in an ocean that experiences tides. Those tides were linked originally to reproduction in the earliest stages of life because of the way in which they tended to bring together nascent forms of life that could then exchange genetic material, and which led to the development of complexity. It has become part of the actual way in which we physiologically experience even the reproduction of complex mammals. It's still linked to the moon, to the point where, of course, the Soda Ibur, as it's spoken about in terms of Rosh Hashanah, maybe you think simplification. You try learning Rosh Hashanah, or you try learning the Goyim. Sure, simple. That's the most complicated subject that you can get into. And so much for simplification. And yet those indeed are the two issues that are mostly directly connected to the elements of information, translation, which becomes the grandeur of life. Remarkable, right? You know, so here the two, we looked at two, they're being just a coincidental interrelationship. First of Leda to Nega, okay, it turned out to be very meaningful, the translation information. Then of Zuria to Nega, whoa. Then of Zuria to the moon overall. Now we're talking about the nature of the original processes of reproduction, earliest stages of life, directly to the moon and the way in which we still experience them. So that when you learn about the Soda Ibur, one of the most fascinating issues is what is the impact upon reproduction of Rosh Chodesh. This is Nogea, every woman's midays. In other words, how does one define a period if it occurs on a particular day of the month, if Beis Din changes the Rosh Chodesh? But it's Nogea many things. It's Nogea, will Betulim grow back? And so on and so forth. These are all part of that same strange interrelationship with the moon. Okay, I'm going to go into details here, but again, we should write that down to breathe. So then things are not as simple as we believe. And therefore, what we need to understand is that, remarkably, the very specific issue that we talk about here in terms of other, remember, we're talking about Yom HaShemini. Yom HaShemini is a very, very important reason to start, and it's a direct continuation, which is part of the Uba Yom HaShemini Yimo Besar Lato. Uba Yom HaShemini, he's able to bring his korban, the same korban as brought on Yom HaShemini and Miluim, which this is a direct continuation of, which doesn't seem to have any direct relation to, is nonetheless central to understanding all of the issues here on every level. Because what Yom HaShemini is, and to such an extent this is true that it doesn't even have anything to do with the Jewish particular constant refrain of Shemini, but even, it's interesting, the first book that was put out on manipulating DNA artificially was called The Eighth Day. The reason it was called The Eighth Day was because it was obvious, the vision that we have of creation, meaning the things that are given, we call the 7 days of creation. And that's just a way of referring to it because of its original biblical presentation. But the eighth day obviously implies, okay, now what? That eighth day, now what, is exactly what we're dealing with over here. The eighth day, now what, in terms of the development of language and how that language can be misused. The eighth day in terms of Mila, which, as all the Rishonim point out, is taking the process that's given to you biologically into your own hands. And therefore, it's really the eighth day in terms of manipulation. And as so many of the Gemaras point out, I mean, that's the Tornis Trophus Rabbi Akiva discussion, where Tornis Trophus says, I mean, what is better, the way God does things or the way humans do things? You know, obviously, questioning why in the world you would want to ruin that which God has done so perfectly. And Rabbi Akiva points out the obvious, you know. Here's a nice, delicious cake from Marzipan. and here's some wheat. What would you rather have? What do you think is better, what God made or what the bakery made? Obviously what the bakery made. It's all part of the development that goes on after the eighth day. The same thing is true, of course, of Rosh Chodesh. The nature of the Shabbos is a given, and it's expressed in our Tfilot. That's the Kadesh HaShabbat. Rosh Chodesh is not a given, because Rosh Chodesh is a local phenomenon. Nobody will know what the heck you're talking about. What is Rosh Chodesh? First of all, where on the earth are you that you're calling it Rosh Chodesh? And when you say Rosh Chodesh, what do you mean? What you mean, the astronomical description of the new moon? Is that what you mean? Gosh, I never heard them ever talk about that in shul. They don't even talk about the real Moed. They talk about an absurd oversimplification, which they call the mean Moed, which never ever happens. So whatever year in shul is irrelevant. You have to look up on a chart to find out when, in terms of the actual reflection of the light of the moon versus the sun, at what point the moon would be completely invisible, and then the first second in which you'd be able to see it, theoretically, I mean, of course, not accounting for any problems of atmospheric conditions, placement, and so on and so forth. So what exactly is a Rosh Chodesh? Rosh Chodesh is nothing. It has something to do with when you, in that position, theoretically, if it weren't daylight, and therefore you can't make it out, and theoretically, if you were in such and such a location, and that then you would be able at least to see with the receptors that you have available in your eyes, which means it's going to take at least 6 hours before you'd be able to notice the thin sliver of moon. Okay, we call that Rosh Chodesh. You're talking about a completely local thing. So obviously when we make our tefillot when it comes to Rosh Chodeshim, it's Mikadesh Yisrael of Rosh Chodeshim. But the same thing is true in terms of all these informational issues. There's two issues that we talk about in information. One of them is the simple description. Information is something that makes a difference. Therefore, you call it information. So you say it makes a difference. We could be talking about something like quantum evolution. It made a difference to survival. That makes it information. Is anybody aware of that information? Now, you don't have to be aware of that information. Since it has a physical impact, it now becomes information because it's preserved. It's a particular set within a molecule that reproduces itself. It's great. So you have a replicating molecule. But you have a different level of information in which the significance that is being measured is being measured in terms of consciousness, and only in terms of consciousness. It's because I view this as information, which to me is significant, now it becomes information. That type of information has a relationship to the way the world is, only in very strange ways, which we're not even sure of. I mean, yes, one interpretation of quantum mechanics is that that type of information really makes a difference in the physical universe. Somebody collapses the wave function by looking at it, and the world now perhaps switches into a particular universe, and that was the one that you looked at, or whatever number of interpretations you want. But somehow or other, the actual consciousness of the thing makes a difference. But let me tell you something. Supposing that you discovered that you were living in a simulation. Now, you want to signal to the simulator. How could you signal to the simulator? Anything that you would do would simply be part of such an immense amount of data that is being recorded in the simulation that there's no chance it's going to be noticed. You're just doing the things that happen in the simulation. The only thing that you could possibly do is you would have to relate to the simulator along the lines that you figure out on what the simulator is looking for. So in other words, if I'm playing a game of simulation, I am going to be sensitive to particular output. I'm not interested in all of the data that's around the peripherals, correct? Because all of that can go this way, can go that way, it really doesn't interest me. What I want to see is anything interesting to me going to emerge from the simulation, correct? This happens very often in artificial intelligence. You want to create a particular type of intelligence, let's say, give it a program which allows it to anticipate the moves of another intelligent entity, whether robotic or human. So then, what will you look for? I'm using this as, I guess it was just a recent, it was a recent thing that actually happens. I'm using this as an example. But what would you look for in the output? You would look for evidence of an anticipation that had been used. So what did they discover in creating this program? They discovered a robot that could trap another robot by figuring out where that robot would go in order to deliver something it needed and then trap it up. Because I could figure out where you would be going, you would definitely choose that route instead of that. Very simple program. But the fact is that the utilization of anticipation seems to you much closer to, I mean, the AI people are always looking for evidence of nonsensical work, but whatever. To them, that's important. I'm saying if you're running a serious simulation, you would look for evidence of what it is that's important to me. That is to say, properties that exist on my emergent level. I'm not interested in all of the data that's coming in. I mean, who's got the time to look at all of this? Who's got the interest to look at all of this? So any signal would, by definition, be an attempt to relate on the level of the simulator, right? But that's teeth, if you think of it. In other words, the Adam who's originally put into the world is put in the world of Dovo L'Shamro, because Rashi defines that means feeling. As measures, that means to be off, kind of, because always have other means. And therefore, the problem is that in, let's imagine creation is a simulation. So in this creation, everything sort of works, but it works without the presence of consciousness. The difference, of course, is that pre-consciousness, what you have is a mist. Ve'ed ya'alem in ha'aret. And that's a description of what it takes to create. And in fact, in terms of geological time, that's what you have. You have a planet that is misty. Have the type of systems, weather systems that you have. Now, mist is generic. Why is it generic? Because it's completely entropic. It doesn't contain any information. What it means is that the water molecules have succeeded in spreading equally throughout the atmosphere. It's all misty. A cloud is a violation of entropy. It's the opposite of a mist. So that the two versions, the presence of the Shekhinah within an anan, as opposed to pre-Adam being a mist. And that is actually learned out one from the other in terms of the Anane HaKoved, where we learn how the Eid Yalam in Haaretz, an actual Wakalamaisa of the inability to be Makabal Tuma on the Tzchach of your Sukkah, for God's sake. That's how serious the limud is, right? That's the presence of Adam. It was right there. The Eid Yalam in Haaretz comes along to Kodesh Baruch Hu, doesn't like a misty planet. Because somebody should be aware. And mist is no data. Because entropy is no data. So to creating now a universe which has no significant data to me, what is the point now of recognizing everything that happens randomly within a no data universe? That's a heck of a boring simulation. Therefore, it's machayev at that moment. The creation of, as Rashi says, someone who would be makir b'tobatan shel gishami, who knows the difference. That's l'chol marei ne'a kohen. And then that makir could come and be mitpalel aleihem. Now all of a sudden there's a signal, whoops, hey, one second, pick that up. So now you've got an Adam that's talking to me. Now we're getting serious over here. We've got some serious data on the level that I'm looking for. This is that second level of information. And that's the difference between a pre-Yom HaShmini and a post-Yom HaShmini. At last, we've got some surprising results, which means that the presence of the Adam, this is the most remarkable thing, does not require an understanding of that which is being uncovered in terms of its complexity. But it does require awareness of those things. In other words, when we're talking about the obvious requirement for the simplification, that does not mean that there's oversimplification. When I say oversimplification has a definition. Oversimplification precludes the utilization of any data that you will be capable of being aware of. That's what oversimplification always does. And in oversimplifying, you destroy the meaning of the creation of Adam. That is the point. The relationship that we have, not only to God, but to the nature of life itself, lies in that curious interface in which the particularly human ability to take absurdly complex situations and make them make sense at some level Now, it doesn't make sense when you start looking into it, but it makes sense certainly on a phenomenological level. I don't need to know anything about gravity. Even if I'm an infant, I'm careful not to fall off the bed a second time. So I have a sense of what gravity does. If you're telling me that the infant really has a developed sense of how space interacts and where it is that I will end up and why and so on, and thinks through whether, is it a force acting from the distance? Is it a warpage in the nature of local space? None of that is important. But what is important? In order to be human instead of merely animal, is to be able to ask those questions. The fact that it may take you thousands of years to get the answer is not the problem. Someone who oversimplifies it says, well, what do I need to know? It doesn't interest me. Fact is, I'm careful not to stand too close to the edge of the porch, and I won't fall off the bed. Isn't that what's important? That's what's important to an animal, but it's not what's important to a human being. To the human being, it's the nature of the experience of what it is to live as a conscious being that drives us to, in fact, kulach etzel negayim v'alot, to go there. The same thing obviously is true about Torah itself. You have people that will take the nature of the Torah that is being given and will view it as being generic. And this, of course, is exactly the problem of anichnas b'tchum she'en ha'shalom, which, if you think about it, is exactly what happens on Har Sinai with Nodav Avihu, which is exactly what happens in the Mishkan, the Yom HaShmini, which leads to this Yom HaShmini. It's ultimately the misuse, not merely of humanity, but of information in the human sense. You take the Torah and you reduce it to a generic. You take something which, in which you as an Adam have the capability of not oversimplifying, and if you wish to look into it, not even necessarily simplifying. Go to the edge. Take the very most that you're capable of understanding at this point. Become now the cutting edge of understanding what it is that the Torah is asking of you, or what it is that science is telling you, what it is that nature is telling you. That's what it is to be human. Is that interface between the immediacy of the experience as an animal. And this is exactly which begins the Rashi, which begins the entire story, based on the Medrash. Just as the creation of Adam follows the creation of, at the very end of all of other species. So you have here the most complex development, very, very recent, just a few thousand years old of history, childhood of the species. You know, if you think about it, it's very difficult for us to imagine because our vision has so changed over the past 100 years. But when you imagine at the time of David HaMelech talking about ki elef shanim be'enecha ki yom etmol ki yavor, do you understand that elef shanim in the eyes of David HaMelech took you back to prehistory? Elef shanim, gosh, that's a hell of a lot of years. To us, what is elef shanim? Elef Shanim is nothing. But you get used to the idea of living in a universe that's 13 plus billion years old, and you casually throw about hundreds of millions of years in describing species and geological periods, and you talk about a human history, which you can easily see, this is that thousand years, and that is that thousand years, this a thousand years, it's nothing. Heck, I know people from 150 years ago who knew people from 100, I mean, it's just a few generations. What's a thousand years? David has no imagination. Elef shanim be'necha. Eh, I mean, that's even be'nai ki yom etmol ki yavor. I need God to say that. You understand how powerful this vision of what it is to be human, how it completely changes, develops, grows in new perspectives. So that was once, what was once obvious, what was once mechanical, becomes now profoundly integrated into the development of life itself, and therefore comes along the Torah here remarkably. One of the most amazing things is the Marsha asks the Kasha. The Gemara in the Dorin says that you want to see how great Mila is. It is so important that it's even Docha Shabbat. Right? That's pretty impressive. Comes along, now listen to this amazing Gemara. This is Rav Yosef. Comes along, Rabbi Nechemia says, Shabbos? Gedrela Mila Shedochet HaNegaim? Says the Marsha, I understand. Negaim, what's the big issue of Negaim? Obviously, what it's talking about over there is where you have a nega tzaraz on a foreskin. Are you supposed to cut off that foreskin? You're supposed to leave the foreskin. Normally, we're told here, hishamer b'nega tzaraz. Don't you dare attempt to deal with this nega tzaraz mechanically. That's what you always do. So you have these nutters, as Ron puts it in Harry Potter. You have these nutters that call themselves doctors by cutting themselves, cutting people up. No, no, says Ron. No, these are healers, not those nutters. And of course, this is the way in which we deal with malignancy. So what do we do? We cut people up. This is a real solution for malignancy. You understand how primitive this is going to be looked at when there's finally an understanding. Problem is, of course, this is not just medicine we're talking about. This is not just grandeur in this view of life. This is the ultimate medicine. People don't understand that. Medicine as a whole is a brand new science. Maybe 50 years old, to some point. But when it comes to the question of dealing with malignancy, you're talking about something that has barely begun. Because what was the approach of malignancy? I don't know, look around for something maybe that'll kill a guy, but just barely allow him to live, so that way we can kill whatever cancer cells are there. If they come back, kill him again. Chances that he'll get out of that alive, you understand, very small, much less than, you know, the chances that he survived the cancer itself at least for 6 months. No, but kill him the first month. Or cut him up. Take out half of him. Right, what else are you going to do? We don't know anything yet. We have no way of dealing with the issue. For God's sake, deal with the issue. Figure out what happened. What caused the cell to become cancerous? What exactly is going wrong that you can address with information? What are you, a bunch of primitives? This is the way you're going to cure a disease? By destroying the body? You can always irradiate him. Oh, my God. I mean, it's horrifying. It's literally witch men. Well, these are doctors. These are witch doctors. Because we don't know anything about it. So we're basically as utterly primitive as an Egyptian doctor would have been at the time of Moshe. He's got a cancer. He'll do exactly. They did this, by the way. They did brain operations.
Yeah.
Yeah, they did brain trepanations. I thought it was evil spirits, but whatever. But they opened up brains and, you know. And the patients survive. They have lots of skulls that have doctor drills in them. As a matter of fact, the Gemara uses a doctor drill as a skull drill as a actual measurement for shear. But that's about where we're holding. That's all that it is. Completely and totally primitive. Says the Torah, we're going to cut off the negat sarat. That's the way you're going to deal with the negat sarat. Or you're going to figure out what's wrong. You have to figure out what's wrong. What leads to this type of misuse? That's what the Rambam is saying. Look, this may be one word, and it's one word that contains all types of different meanings. Why do I need to point that out? Why do I need to repeat that? But the bottom line, he says, the issue is that you're going to have to learn that this is a process that forces you to process yourself. What's your problem? You've got a problem. You have to figure out what that problem is. So what is the combination of the issues? Does the Rambam say that these are miracles? That the sick house and the sick clothing is a miracle? No. See, that's the point. He's so careful in his language. He says, Eino miminhago shel olam. It's not the way you expect the world to work. That's all that he says. Obviously, you will find a physical cause for whatever is happening. There's got to be some type of growth that's feeding on this cloth that's causing it to discolor, some type of lichen, maybe that's growing inside of the rocks that you're unable to get rid of or whatever. But that's not the point. Things like this don't usually happen. If they don't usually happen, you're forced to consider the interrelationship of what's going on with your misuse of the world to where the world seems to be abusing you. That's the idea. So again, on the simplistic level, okay, throw things together, says the Rambam. Call it all the same. But when you really get down to it, you've got to realize, says the Rambam, look, I mean, first, somebody speaks Lashon Hara, he notices changes in his home. Im Chazar, though, if he manages to work out what he's doing wrong, okay, he'll be able to fix the house. But then he keeps going on Madbury Show until the house is lost. Then he'll start seeing closer to home issues. His clothing starts going bad. Chazarbo, Yitarut, Imamad Bishrisho, until we have to burn his clothes. So now he'll get cancer in his skin. Chazarbo, and so on and so forth. Let him work it out. So that means, yes, of course, it's all the same. Sure. It's all the same in the grossest way, it's all the same. Because what we're interested in on the local level is, okay, what are you going to do with this? But in terms of cutting it off, you've got to be crazy. That's not a solution. And yet, therefore, comes over to Nehemiah. Can you imagine that Brit Milah, which you would assume is a much cheaper solution? I mean, big deal. You know, anybody can learn in 10 minutes how to do a Brit Milah, and that's all there is to it. 10 days. Depends on which mile, unfortunately. Okay. But anybody can learn how to do a Brit Milah, and it's not a big deal. So, yeah, you're going to use that to be Deicha, the very thing that the Torah says. Don't you dare play mechanically with underlying issues. You want to see how important Brit Milah is? Well, you think it's just primitive? On the contrary, it's so chashuv that it's Deicha, even Negat Zaraz. Now it begins to make sense. That's already an answer to the Marshal's question. I mean, like, what do I need to know that if I know it's Deicha Shamas? Koshikin is going to be Deicha in Negat Zaraz. And that means that in terms of our dealing with life, what we often do on a simple level is we oversimplify. And if you're talking about, as the Tsar was talking about, oh, those issues, those are Freudian issues. Don't ever say those words. Don't learn not to put kalon, is what it's saying. There's nothing scandalous about these issues. These are the issues of life itself. But that's too complicated. What do I need to get into complexities for? That's why you exist. You exist to be the hook, the one hook we spoke about earlier. The Vavei Amudim, the one hook that allows for connection of the rest of the universe to the source of the simulation. That's the nature of your tefillah. That's the nature of you. But more importantly, this oversimplification, you have no idea how profoundly it reaches. The fact that we need to be at play. Being at play means I never take seriously what it is that I've created for myself as a solution. If you take a look at the nature of religion, the main problem is that it takes itself so seriously. It seriously believes that it has solutions. It's capable of telling you the nature of life. One of the things that the Rambam so powerfully brings out is never the point of Torah to give you solutions. There are no solutions. Remarkably, in our experience, brings this out beautifully, Newton. One of the great things about science is that a true scientist never believes that he really has solutions. In other words, he understands that the nature of the human experience is that you're open to the most insane possibilities. So that Newton says of himself,
I was like a boy playing on the seashore and diverting myself now and then, finding a smoother pebble or a prettier shell than ordinary, whilst the great ocean of truth lay all undiscovered before me.
Right, it starts off with the words, I know not what how it is that others see me, but to myself.
That I didn't know.
Okay. So Newton says, yes, everybody thinks that I've discovered truth. I don't know how everybody else looks at me. But I see myself as a child playing. And every once in a while you find some nice combination of stones. Well, I got this big ocean. You're at the ocean, at the shore. You're enjoying playing with the little few seashells that you've discovered, you know. And wow, this is hot stuff. Well, you have this vast ocean of truth that's untouched. Amazingly, the most supposedly sophisticated scientists could come up with exactly the same kind of and believe they have solutions. You take the Dawkins. Okay, he's brilliant. Very, very solid evolutionary biologist. But the fool believes that he has some connection to the overall structure of reality. So since I have figured out that there is no Lego playing in this simulation, therefore there's no simulator. Did that make any sense to anybody in this room?
Yeah.
I mean, that makes sense to you. Since there's no Lego playing, therefore there's no simulation. I mean, the two things are completely unrelated, obviously. But since my entire life consists of only describing the limited local experience I have with the nature of reality, you understand that in 50 years, I mean, that could be so absurdly funny that people will literally be using this for a comedy book. And yet, after having stripped away all of the previous generation's delusions and writing books about delusions, he's ready to go ahead and have a solution, which will never be looked at as a delusion. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Completely,
nonsense of a higher order. Yeah. Exactly. You just completely continue this process in which you understand you don't even have a usable theory of everything. For the simple physical universe, you have contradictory theories, so that you're holding still on the edge of some serious interpretation of reality, but you're coming along and telling you you understand everything perfectly well. There are no Lego players. And it's almost impossible to get away from this, because wherever there is some level of something that allows you to take what was previously oversimplified and see it in a slightly more complex fashion, your human tendency will be to make that l'chomarei. But it isn't to make that the Torah. So now we have that. What did you do before the Brisker Rav came along and gave you the insight into what the Rambam said? Yeah, but now we have the Brisker Rav. Or as they put it in the introduction to the Rav Chaim al Rambam, this represents the final, beautiful, and complete approach. You know, as opposed to all those other things that people were putting out, and we have no responsibility for those stencil things and so on. This is the reality, as if it matters. So, you know, okay. Thank you for your approach. It's 100 years later, what's the approach now? But it is exactly the same issue on all of the elements of Torah. To utilize the same medieval metaphors that are utilized by the Maharal, to use that thought to describe reality, comes across as absurdly medieval. You're going to speak about an Aristotelian universe a la Rambam. Because if that's the maximum that we can use for our metaphors, what happened to you? So as we constantly say, the people who were limited by those realities would have given their right hands to escape the limits of those realities. But you are magdish in an oversimplification. This is our reality. I mean, it's unbelievably shocking. Where does such a thing come from? That's the Shechorot Ko'orei, the essence of Shechorot Ko'orei. And so that play that we do, recognizing that we are always on the seashore, and always play, is the essence of being a bugger. And if you think about it, it's the experience of life. That's exactly what we experience. What we attempt to do is to reduce things to some type of academic discussion. So we will sit here and sagaciously questioning the issues of, so what do we hold as the real meaning of Halakha L'Moshe Sinai? What is the historical proof of Torah? What is the ontological proof of God? Blah, 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 blah. You understand? All of this while we are experiencing life within an organism that doesn't have a clue about itself. Nothing about itself. And what's amazing is that you start off life knowing everything. In other words, a teenager had this great thing on my refrigerator. You know, teenagers, getting sick of your parents bossing you around, act now while you still know everything. Leave. Make your own money. It's like a grit. You know, but it's got to be fast because you're going to figure out very soon you don't know a thing. You know what's going to happen. So the older you get, the more mature you get, the more a joke you seem to yourself. Forget about what I think I know. I gradually come to understand. I don't expect to be what I'm talking about. But certainly when it has anything to do with oneself, you're in a constant state of confusion. Why am I acting in contradictory fashions? What made me this way? Why can't I be the way I think I was, but now realize I never was, and so on and so forth? I mean, the whole thing is a mystery. And you find yourself asking yourself all the time as you get older and older, so what do you think about that? And answering, I don't have a clue. I don't think about anything, basically. And that is the human condition. That's exactly what it is. The way that the common saying among the rich of Tachlit Hayidya Shalonida. But that is really, really true. The more developed you become, the more you recognize the local vision that you live with and pretend that you play with. Is this wrong? No. It's a chomar ha'ener kohen. It's atem when it comes to Kiddush HaKodesh, even if you don't have a clue about what you're talking about. Afilu mutin. You're completely mutin. You have the wrong formula, you idiots. Oh, well, says HaKodesh Baruch Hu, what can I do? Emi mo'adim aleinu. This is the way they want to be korei. Oh, do I have a choice? We've got to go along with what's happening, you know. So, I guess it's Pesach. I swore it was Hetzmach. That's really what it's like. So, yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. That is the human condition. Of course it's hilarious. And of course, do we constantly make our efforts at getting a little bit closer? Sure we do. But listen, Newton, it wasn't just that he simplified. He created a mathematics that made it possible to simplify. And that the whole point of calculus was to take something which has no solution and to pretend it has a solution. By getting closer and closer to the value you're looking for, even though there's no way that you can ever find it. So it's by definition, it's a simplification. You've got to take that seriously as a description of reality. Of course, I'm playing. I understand that I'm playing. Heck, after all, I don't even know if there is such a thing as mathematics. That too may be a creation. I can't even figure that out, you understand. After thousands of years of the best minds of humanity, millions and millions of man years spent on figuring out the entire structure of mathematics, we'll never know whether it really exists. There is no way to know whether it really exists. It's always going to be a function of our interpretation of reality. There's no possible way, which that itself is one of the most brilliant mathematical feats, there's no possible way to get a mathematical answer as to whether what it is that your system is represents truth. It's impossible. It will always be incomplete. But that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about the human essence as a Gödelian incompleteness theorem. Wherever you are, you will always simply be in that interface between what it is that you see and interpret and its necessary simplification. As for Moshe will give us a big smile, the more simplification, the better. We ought to really get that wry look. It's the Miller stare. I mean, it deserves to be put onto film.
Speaking for a moment so we don't...
At least he preserved the camera.
So Einstein said that a solution to a problem should be as simple as possible and not more so.
It's a very good way to put it. And so we are left with a marvelous insight into the nature of kahuna, specifically, and to a mamlechet kohani, in which you have to serve two contradictory functions. On the one hand, you need to be able to be the adam, that is, mekasher, the world, to those who would live within it in a way that allows them their local lives in a very simplistic life. To the point that the kohen, to some extent, doesn't even have a local life. He is in service. So the Gemara needs a raya that a kohen is chayiv in sukkah. I mean, he doesn't have a normal house, so why would he be chayiv in sukkah at all, right? Wherever we have hakol chayavim, the ex, the Gemara says, what do you mean hakol chayavim? Who's not? Well, I mean, it could be kohanim, levim, why not? What do you mean, why not? A kohen is normal. A kohen has a normal life. So on one hand, you're talking about being the one, the functionary, who is capable of bringing things to a level of consciousness that comes to avodah, but he has to deal with things that are irreducibly complex and pretend that they're just l'chol mar'ei nei hakohen in terms of hora'ah. Kasher yorucha, whatever that is, the kasher yorucha is good enough so that the placement of a mamlechet kohanim in the nature.
They tell you to mean small you mean, right? To that point.
What is the point?
That they can even be wrong. It's
no,
your
that,
reality.
That isn't true. That isn't true.
They're disagreeing with your reality.
Yes, I don't want to buy into that because it's misused itself. And it's not really true the way that it's used. Okay. As the chinuch makes clear, it's only on what's near lekachas smoke. You mean you're not allowed to be semech on bezdin to violate your reality. If you do your chayv of carbon, it's the hirah bezdin is not going to pot. That's the point.
Right.
That's the shogig, as the Gemara says. The shogig was the guy thought I can rely on Bezdin. You can't rely. Okay,
but you're right. You're right, isn't that? You think it's right.
Yeah. But again, we're getting back to the mamlechet kohanim. So it becomes your job to be the ones who are always indeed playing on the seashore. And it's Klal Yisrael that is profoundly resented for that, because you'll never buy in to a local reality. A member of Yisrael always threatens a comfortable local reality, whether it's the social reality or whether it's Jewish physics, which thank God saved the Second World War from being won by the Germans, which we're not interested in Jewish physics. We want down-to-earth serious physics that led all of the nuclear scientists to get to the West, and so on and so forth. That kind of approach is always resented on every level, whether it's in terms of art, whether it's in terms of science, whether it's in terms of society itself. It's always the thing which is going to be cutting edge because it does not take itself seriously enough to give up on the Lulei Torat HaShashuai and takes most seriously the way in which we interpret that information, because that in the end is the way that the randomness of a universe as a whole is brought to some level of significance, is informational significance, not just in terms of what is, but in terms of what could be, and its relationship to purpose in the original creation of my separations itself. Therefore, Shmini is always, the Yom HaShmini is what is done with creation. It's what brings it back to creation. It's the reason that we have over here all of the Inyanim of Gan Eden revisited. It's why it is that the human condition in the end has to deal with the issues that went sour through our inability to live in a utopian situation in which everything is what it is. When things are what they are, they might as well be just a mist of fog. The foggiest things that we can imagine are things as they are. What it is that we need to discover is the things that take on the grandeur of the particularism of the presence of the Shekhinah in an unknown, of the Nafkamina, of how it is that we utilize the same things that everybody else is utilizing without thinking about them once. The experiences of going to a bathroom in which nobody else pays any attention, and which to us is a direct coming into contact with the nature of an Adam's appreciation, the development of his own protoplasm, of what's involved in what it takes to be human, with an appreciation of the simplest physical activities of life as touching on the most complex issues that could ever be really achieved by a human being, which after all of the development of science, we haven't even begun to really understand, just starting to take apart the structure of the genome. Forget about whether we have any understanding of how to translate it piece by piece, or to know how that translation actually affects the phenotypical impact on the world around us. No, none of that yet. Wait 20 years, 50 years, 100 years, whatever it will take, until there's enough information to deal with malignancy as information instead of nothers. And this, in the end, is the process of birth, which is the process of rebirth of Malchus David, of the entire nation, the idea of integration, David Melech Yisrael Chai V'Kayam, the reconstruction of a universe that is no longer just foggy, but has within it all of the potential that was originally there and yet understood it to be meaningful human information that can send a signal outside and beyond itself.
Questions? Go. Moshe Binyamin.
Yes, that's it.
What's the significance of the grass?
The grass.
Why is the grass the one thing that waited for everything else that was there? And if also you see grass doesn't respect any boundaries, where the trees create boundaries. It was only grass that was that needed the Vakeshrachim.
The creation of boundaries. Grass was the only thing that created its own boundary. That was so beautiful.
And not physical.
But I'm saying it's funny that today trees on land is what creates ownership and boundaries. Or grass, it's just everywhere. But the question is, why was grass the thing that waited?
The amazing thing is that grass created the boundaries of information in the Bria. That was what was so beautiful. That was the Yismach Hashem B'Mahasav. That grass decided on the necessity for maintaining genetic integrity, despite the fact that it was grossly mixed. The whole point is Rashi brings. That's the Gemara. You know, since we mix physically, what would make us recognizable if we don't maintain genetic integrity? So they made the Kal Vachomer of Bimino over and above the trees. I think it's beautiful. It's stunning.
And then what happens later on with Noah?
Also.
No, but it's also grass. But it's also the
I mean, he got drunk. He wasn't on grass.
No, but the response to the...
He knows something.
No, the response.
I mean, we have to assume that he took grass into the table. I mean, otherwise we wouldn't understand.
No, that wasn't the question. It was just an added thing. I mean, but yes. What about later on by Noah? Wasn't there a difference in how what she planted? It was only true by the grass. What she planted came up with the Seder as opposed to...
The difference with Kotsarda, I don't think so. I mean,
it's a grass issue.
It's in the same general tone, but I'm not sure that it's in the... Maybe weed.
Well, another issue. Rebbe made a play.
Maybe he had weed on there, too. I mean,
here's an observation. Rebbe made a play on the address.
No weed in that.
Rebbe made a play on the word address with the Bible.
It was on the word issue.
It was on the word issue.
Oh, I thought, because the address, because, you know, the thing in information history, in the history of information technology, has been addressing. It was the thing that went from the telephone, you know, digital, and even now we're on, you know, the bridge of the edge of photonics. Again, it's addressing the signal.
Okay, thank you. Move on now. Thank you, Rav Moshe Binyon. And now Rav Moshe. Here we go.
Leo. It's very nice. Slasemes. It says the same volume from different angles, but the one which I found very beautiful, he asks the question that the Kohen is the Orev Shalom or Roedev Shalom. So he understands that the Kohen should be the Merape, but he should be the one to be covered that the person is sick. It's against the whole Mahus of the Kohen. He says, no, that's a good Gufainya to be able to say you are sick. You have to do something about it. Not showing it is the worst possible thing. You have to take it, bring it out.
This is actually a good thing. Quote over here, if you start to think about your physical or moral condition, you usually find that you're sick. Yes.
And me?
Okay. Oh, Yechiel.
All right, well, I have a couple.
It's very easy to identify all the people if you just remember one word.
It's confusing for a person. I have a couple, actually, so. All right, first of all, it's actually really cool in the Matrix. First of all, the introduction, the opening scene is like it starts off with all those letters and then you zoom into to the reality. And you see the relationship between the people. The only person who really sees the letters while he's in the reality is Neo, and he's the only one who actually really, you know, has anything what to...
That's a very good point.
It's also the agents always view things only in the letters. Yeah. And the humans only view things in terms of the reality.
Excellent. The Neo, of course, is the moon. That's the Chodesh.
Okay, cool.
That's exactly the word that we use, is Neo. That's what makes
really,
it.
That's really cool. Okay.
Beautiful. Second, things work, usually.
Second, another movie reference. I'll just get them out of the way before I get into the other stuff. Stranger Than Fiction, actually. Rebbe saw, right? So
this is being video.
What's interesting there is the scene where when he calls the author, they had no way in the movie of communicating, and it was the point of the movie that I felt was weakest when I was watching. It was like they had to find a loophole instead of having it emerged.
You're right. It was a very weak. It was very excellent.
And an otherwise amazing movie.
Yes, it was a very troublesome piece. How in the world are you going to knock on the door of the author?
Yeah. Also, it wasn't even
the whole point. It's different orders of reality. I felt that was all very...
Yeah. Plus, it didn't even keep to the structural integrity of the author's reality.
Okay. Whatever. Look. You know. Now we finished the movie review section of this week's. Let us move on.
Okay. Okay. So. What was the next one? The problem is my handwriting.
You want to take some time to look it over while we move on to someone else?
Yeah, that could work.
Okay, there may be some non-Moshes with questions in the room.
I have a number of questions.
Meir Simcha.
Okay, first, I'm sorry, Rebbe, but this is a very practical question. What are we doing?
That's the Adam, simple Adam.
But this is a question that will help me bridge to the next level. So what are we doing in tefillah? What are we doing in tefillah?
Ooh, that runs on. Did you ever hear the quest for avodah on tefillah?
I've heard bits and pieces.
Bits aren't enough.
I didn't even realize it was about tefillah when I was listening to it.
Second
series.
Yes, I will bring that up a little bit, way more, but the questions and answers. Nothing's ever online. We have enough roles. Heck, I haven't set the links.
Have you sent the links out last year?
Yes. Years, yeah, but you listened to things the last year. It took Lydia. Yes. If I'd listened, we would have injected you with some woman earlier. Yes.
Okay, so just an observation.
I'm
sure you're aware of it, but Philo, when he's talking about self-knowledge, what you're saying reverberates with what he's saying.
Coelet?
Philo.
Oh, Philo.
Yeah, that he says that we spend all the time looking at stars and the sun and the moon and trying to understand the world around us, but we don't even turn on ourselves, try to understand ourselves, for we are the prism through which we see the world. Right. We see all this stuff and that.
That was a very early description of the whole issue. Mm. And just as humanity was coming into the awareness of that, it was so easy to mistake a reality for a reality. It was so recent. Even viewing it as prison, I think, was very good. Which was more?
Just something. Things that disturb me about Jews. one of which is like, look, that, it's all too complicated. I just want to know what to do. That's something I hear a lot about.
That's not all. On the contrary. I mean, we spoke about this. Is it really a book of the universe for dummies? That was the question. Is the universe for dummies? And the truth is, there is a universe there for dummies. And there are a lot of people that go through life as dummies. The question is whether the universe can survive as a universe for dummies. Because the nature of Adam is changing from being a universe for animal dummies on that level, who can function and who can even do quantum mechanics if somebody else teaches it to them. But they're still dummies. They just apply simple things that children can apply. You know what they call the quantum cookbook. You take your algorithm and everything's fine. Without any interest, any concern, what does this mean? What does it say to me about my perception of reality? That doesn't interest me. That's way too complicated. I mean, as long as I can apply some formula, can the universe survive with those type of dummies? I mean, what the Torah is saying is that the essence of Adam is to insist the world is not their dummy, and that its entire connection, and again, I think a simulation is a great metaphor, because it's something that we can understand,
that we would go about doing. If we were creating, we would do so through simulations. And what we would like to see in those simulations is what comes out of the randomness of interactions of massive complexity. That's what's interesting to us. How does something form itself? And that would be the deepest creativity, remarkably, that we could have, is by setting up the conditions that would allow for that type of simulation. And it's because of that that we understand that such things have interest only insofar as they're not exactly repetitions, iterations of the same data without any significance that's noticed outside of the system. And that is essentially what we're talking about in tefillah. I mean, it's the first time in which there's a way to communicate inside to outside. And therefore, it's not surprising that our vision of Adam, qua Adam, is as the Oved and Shomer, the one whose avodah is directly connected to Shmira. So that balance that ultimately keeps a universe moving is meant to be Adam's balance, and we're constantly searching that balance. You know, and it's always corrected. It's always like these vast swings in which the more intelligent we become, the more we're capable of anticipating the dangers of the swings and acting on them on any level, whether it's economic swings, ecological swings, or philosophical swings, sociological swings. We're becoming more and more in touch with the dangers of those swings and how it is that we need to, as B'nai Adam, to anticipate and to act upon those anticipations, to integrate and to make this sustainable. That the greatest terror that we have is this, the sense that things are not being properly anticipated and that perhaps it is not sustainable, specifically because of our inability to act upon our anticipations. It's very much the modern condition, is that we're aware enough to know how central our activities are and how balanced a system of information is. And this is so recent. I mean, it's just incredible. If one could say, that there is one issue that is the issue of the development of the postmodern era. It's the awareness of the delicacy of balance on every level. When we used to think there was a world out there in which what we do exists separate from that reality. We do two things. We don't do within things. We experience things, but we're not part of the experience. Everything boils down to the same issue. The development of quantum mechanics and the development of ecological awareness are fundamentally the same development, remarkably, because they are the development of understanding that human beings don't exist outside of a system. They are part of the system. So whether it's the system of physics, which they're attempting to analyze from the outside, or it's the simple disposal of waste products, which they believe could be done as living on the outside, we've managed to discover there is no such thing. It's imaginary. And this started, I mean, really, if you think about it, started, scientifically speaking, it started from a transitional period in which the classical definitions of space-time were changed by Einstein within the same system, really. It was still classical physics. It was still very much a Newtonian physics. All it did was change our perception of the interrelationship of ourselves and space-time, or object and space-time. That was a massive change, which in the end actually presaged the full understanding of to what extent we're talking about our involvement in the system, to the point where I'd left Einstein behind him, and it was too crazy that it could possibly have reached that level. And yet he himself, as I think we spoke about last week, he himself saw this as something of an optical illusion in which human beings believe that they're somehow outside of the universe and they are looking from the outside upon it. And that sense of selfhood and speciesism and so on is all related to, even in his own mind, to what it was that he was experiencing as a human being who actually became aware not of a world outside, but of how intimately related the world inside and the world outside are, to really see it as an illusion. That is an amazing development, and it penetrates every level of our politics, our social policies, our scientific discoveries, and the concerns that we have about the future of the world. It's an amazing thing.
I think we're going back, I'm not sure, but I think perhaps we're going back to that. I think there was a time we may see in more primitive cultures that they did see themselves as part.
Yes, they saw themselves as part, but the crucial word here is, and the operative word is, primitive. And the reason that therefore that doesn't matter is because that was still the universe for dummies. In essence, every animal experiences itself as an organism only contextually within its interrelationship with an external universe. You know, sometimes there are those who mistake this for more what they call being there, but it's actually far less being there. In other words, you need to go through, the same way you need to go through the reductionism in order to get to the level of the integration that science is capable of. And this disturbs people, the reductionism, where obviously the whole point of such reductionism is exactly what you're doing in the Gemara, when you're reducing a fantastically complex interrelated sugya to some type of small question which could never arise in reality. Well, no laboratory situation can arise in reality. The reason we create laboratory situations is in order to be able to see the complexity that this is constructed of. Let's tease apart the pieces. Once those pieces are teased apart, then when they integrate into something immensely powerful. So it's exactly the same thing as saying that the number of neuron connections in a newborn is vastly greater than that of an adult, because 90% is sloughed away as the infant develops. That's great. But it doesn't help you think better, having those additional neuron connections. They're potential, but either you slough away or you're left with nothing. That's primitive. Now, primitive systems are not really similar in experience or in kind as the sophisticated systems that have this simple interrelationship, yes, but that's the universe for dummies. And we're talking about a universe that is for anything but dummies. It's exactly the same as Gan Eden. You say, well, in Gan Eden you had everything, but you had nothing. And that's the whole point of choosing the Eitz HaDaat. I can't live with this. Gan Eden is a universe for dummies. And it's Adam as Adam that chose to leave that. That's how profound the desire to be Adam is. I can't live in a universe for dummies. So you say, but what do you mean, dummies? You know everything there is to know. Well, that means I know nothing. I'm only experiencing things as all one thing. And then comes the unavoidable reductionism. And yes, the absurdity of the optical illusion of discovering oneself as if it isn't part of the universe. And at last, what it is that we're coming to discover today in all areas of life. And Kol Shekein in Torah, which is the essence of the Zohar's proclamation, that it's only in the integrated vision of Torah as a description of reality that is, you can see only if it's integrated, that that's the source of Geula. And it's obviously true. It's such a change in paradigm that you cannot conceive of a Geula that is anything but metaphorical unless it's completely embedded in the actual experience of life, in which policy of state becomes a description of Torah, in which the human personality becomes a description of Kabbalah, in which the achievement of humanity is a direct translation of Maaseh Bereishis. That's the only meaning to Geula, not as some kind of strange guy on a donkey who's coming along and carrying out a list of, Brian's commands to the world. Obviously, that's not what we're looking for here. Is Moshe back on? Here we go.
All right. The first one might be a little off
topic. No excuses. Just give it.
But we mentioned earlier the nature of Lashon Hara as being what I wouldn't say in public. Or did I completely misunderstand?
No. Yeah, you did misunderstand that. No, never said.
What we said was
that it's a Maisa Hashoy in the sense that it doesn't stand up to the light. It's something that I will do in order to create a local reality. Psst, you know how to look at that guy? That's maligning.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
If I'm saying it openly, then it's open to discussion, and it's open to, is that really true? And so on. Uh-huh. But what we always do is we restrict. It's in that sense we wouldn't say it in public.
Which was true.
That's the Gemara says, Me'olam lo amarti davar v'chazarti le'achorai. If I'm saying it, I would say it to the face of the person that it's about. Because it's about reality. It's not about an attempt to control reality and do it in secret. That we said, yes.
Which is very amalek. Okay, fine. So that was that. Another thing was the structure of Taraz is actually sort of the opposite of cancer. If you think about it, cancer always affects the internal and then spreads to the external. Structure of Taraz.
Me too. Tarat Noshenet is, that's the point that Rashi makes, that under the surface you've got a terrible situation here with cancers, but which looks good from the surface.
No, but Taraz.
It looks healthy.
No, but doesn't Tzaraat first affect your house, then your clothes, and then your...
Oh, yeah, according to those shittas, yes. So, yes, it comes from the outside in. Yeah, yeah, that's a good point. There are those Rishonim who say the opposite because of that.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, but it starts inside and then spreads to those things which are the extended phenotype, the way Baka put it. It's really a machlokas Rishonim.
Yeah,
the approach that I took was because we were reading the Rambam.
I was just wondering because... Earlier on, I saw a way that could connect, but then I completely lost it when I'm, on camera, obviously.
Beautiful.
I'll think about it, but there's, yeah. All right, so
that's beautiful. That's really nice.
All right.
Yes, indeed. This is Moshe Yechiel.
And so another question was the... we were talking about the Orev as opposed to Ivri,
mm-hmm.
and
right,
yeah, it's not particularly, but anyway, so there's like a lot of with Ivri though you have like Lashon Avera, Avar, Ibor. Well, Ibor makes sense, but like the Avera and the Avar, you wouldn't necessarily tie to Ivri. Well. Is it inherent in the nature of Ivri, or would you say that's more in the nature of Aravi?
No, but it's still in the nature of setting yourself aside instead of just mixing everything. The point of the Aravi is that he's, and that's exactly the way that the Torah describes it. Yado Bakov, Yad Kolbo, he just can't mind his own business.
Me'urav.
Right, so it's a Me'urav in everything. And that's really the whole meaning of Aravi. That's why we look down at that type of culture as being the opposite, in a sense, of the Ivri culture, which is Western civilization until very recently, which is to make things specific, to make things going in a particular direction and so on, and not attempting to reduce. That's the nature of Ovar, to be on the other side while everything goes along in whatever path it wants. The Derech of Islam is exactly the opposite. Take all things, reduce them to the generic, and view anything that is in any way different from the local moments that you have as being evil and in need of destruction, as opposed to something that needs to be looked at and celebrated. To view anything that is any society that's different as needing to be absorbed, and to reduce things to one ummah, to have none of these separations, divisions, and appreciation of an alternative, or to search for other ways of looking at reality. That's unfortunately very much what it is that the West refuses to recognize, is that the one thing you cannot afford to be multicultural about is that which denies multiculturalism. And that's about being liberal about the things that destroy liberalism. I mean, it makes no sense. You know, it's a contradiction in terms, and unfortunately comes at the cost of survival. Okay, any other issues? Maybe those are the bombers on their way right now. Yes, indeed. Always hoping. Yes, indeed. Here's Ira.
Here you go, Mark. Okay. This is more of, I guess, a technical question. It seems like, in Rebbe's terms, it seems like in halacha, we kind of do take ourselves seriously. Like, if these discoveries matter, why don't we use a more exact approximation of pi? Or there's a million examples like this, where there's measurements, low doc, that's just what we use, that's good enough for us, and we don't need to get any more sigma. If it mattered, we think halacha would have built into the mechanisms to update itself later generations, but it seems like, no, once the Gemara was sealed, their approximation of reality was enough for us, and that's what we get, and we'll still use it today. Why is that?
No, that's a very good point. First of all, I just want to point out to you that the elements of lo dak there are based on psukim. In other words, we wouldn't take for granted that we can utilize approximations of pi, let's say. We need a makar to how it is that the Torah would expect us to utilize this thing. However, I must point out to you that in practical terms, we don't. In other words, the tefillin that we buy are tefillin that are much, much more meduyak than they ever were in history, because of the fact that we don't want to rely on pi in that fashion. We don't want to rely on the grosses of the measurements that were accessible up until that time. But there's an important point, I think, over here that may be necessary to consider. And that is that the nature of Torah as a universal to the human condition must be utilizable by the most primitive of humans. That's the point. In other words, when I'm giving you a message, I need to speak to you at a particular point in human development where you're of just enough sophistication for this message to be understood enough in a universe for dummies, but in which you're aware of the differences that complexity makes. And it's because of that that the din of Dibrat Torah Lashon B'nei Adam, unbelievably, is defined by the Gemara by the nature of language at the time of Matan Torah, which is amazing. In other words, if at the time of Matan Torah, the level of biological awareness was such that there were only, let's say, 10 subspecies of Eris. I mean, this is an example that Gemara used. Okay, well, what about today where we have 369,000 different species of Eris? So what would be included in the eight Eris that you would bring, the Ezov that you would bring? Ezov Yevanit, Ezov Kilchit, Ezov Avram. So there the Gemara says the level of sophistication is defined by the sophistication of language at the time of Matan Torah. You would say, okay, that's a coincidence, but it isn't really. Because the davar tzival elev dor, the nature of the tzatke ad dorot, the idea that the Torah is meant to match a particular moment in human development, is also fundamental to the Gemara's view. So that we recognize there's a moment in which the primitive can achieve as a species, as opposed to individuals, which we had up until that point. But the vayish sham legoy, that idea that there can be a species within humanity, a subspecies of humanity that actually exists as Adam, Aten Tiyuli Mamlechet Kohanim, couldn't have been said earlier. And had it been said later, would have been too late. In other words, this is the moment that I want to address. And that's a remarkable fact. It has all types of immense implications, including in terms of the dinim of the trefot and so on. But that, I mean, it's interesting that that's something the Gemara calls the the Alpayim Torah that allows for that development. In a sense, that primal development, as the Chazon Ish suggests, is that the Alpayim Torah has implications for this. In other words, that initial meeting up with Torah maybe allows it up to a certain level of primitiveness and sophistication, which is up to the end of the period of the Tannaim. You know, maybe.
But Avram is the transition.
No, it's the beginning.
It's the beginning. I mean,
it's the beginning, correct, yes. But then you have, you know, you have 2,000 years. The rest is supposed to be about the Mashiach, in which you don't have the stress on development. You have the stress on actualization. Okay, that may be. In practical terms, that's certainly the way we look at it. That v'chilo sifal atreifot batem. I mean, it's irrelevant. You know, again, whether that means there's some type, as JJ suggested before, I mean, there may be some type of relationship that the primitive has that indeed is worthwhile maintaining. That's very possible. But it certainly is not just the primitive. It's the primitive at a point in its development where it's capable of a rather primal relationship with God. The fact that it comes ultimately to question that relationship, which we've seen all the time, and that's the Kafalei Marachigigit, the fact that a primitive level of awareness is always going to look back on coming into contact with God and saying, that's ridiculous. I mean, what are we supposed to do with that? How are we supposed to understand that? We're just beginning to get some sense of ourselves. Of course, it's going to be that way, in the same way that we recognize that Zachati L'Chesed Neurayich from a purely relationship point of view is an abusive relationship where one partner is on a different level of consciousness and awareness than the other partner. But nonetheless, we recognize that there too, there's an opening, which is almost the time of Kabbalat HaTorah. It's a year. A year is given you, 48 days is given you, till you get to Kabbalat HaTorah. Obviously, that idea of Yechezkel, I meet you and you're just beginning to break out in relationship terms, and in terms of your puberty. You're reaching puberty. That puberty is, of course, your das, your ability to relate the world, not only sexually in terms of relationships, but intellectually. I mean, dat has implications for the way in which you do see yourself as different and yet relating to the whole. That's HaKadosh Baruch Hu at that point, as the Gemara says. Yeah. No, that's it's actually at the time of Yitzhak. Yeah, because the vision, the gestalt of HaKadosh Baruch Hu to a primitive Yisrael was as a boy. So there was that youthfulness, there was the Tatalim Shecharot, the version of a more mature version is, I don't need the sexual element that's expressed in the boyhood, which comes to Egel and so on and so forth. So instead I see a Zaken Yoshev B'Yeshiva. But I mean, obviously we need to preserve all of the different gestalt in any real relationship. That's true of a human being too. I mean, you can't relate to another individual without relating to their youth at the same time that you're relating to their current gestalt any more than you relate to yourself. I mean, it's very, very, very poorly imaginative people who relate to themselves as they are currently. I mean, you need to be almost a primitive to experience yourself within that particular instant of, you know, how you would see yourself in the mirror. Most people don't do that. I mean, they may see themselves in the mirror, you know, as it says, what's that cute? Every time you see an old man looking in the mirror, it's really a boy wondering what happened. and that's certainly true. It's like, what? Who's that? And, of course that's the case.
But when we do go through transitions, and as people and as society, we like turn against what we were instead of developing or maintaining. Yes.
That's adolescence. That's adolescence, and that's the adolescence of science, which Dawkins is clearly part of. It's a very youthful but immature reaction to the kind of things that kept you in prison, which, by the way, is one of the, as the Zohar points out, is the translation. It's the Targum of Tzorah, comes the word Tsar, which is you're held into place. You're Sagur. And that Seger is part of your experience of language and information within a very limited context. So that the Tzorah is Tsar 8. It's a very limited time. And that's what happens. People take their limited time space, in which now you need to live. Oh, go out and live on your own. You created artificial reality for yourself. Turn it into a spatial reality, too. But in order to get back into what's really happening, you're going to have to get beyond that. So that the purpose of Tzorat is very, very much, it's much more than metaphorical, obviously, but it's very much the rediscovery of your position in the universe. You want to be part of a society? You want to be part of development? You want to get out of the limits of your time? All of that is Tzorat. So then you must break out of the limitations. We actually call the word that is done for the Tzorat Musgar. It's locked up. That's what it's called. Musgar. Lock it up. Now let's test it again in another week. See whether he's got any brains now. Has there any change?
Chalata also is solid, like I do chalita and I seal in the blood. The chalata also is
excellent.
Even more locked.
And there is Barnea. Yes, indeed. You can get that beautiful view of Barnea. Barnea is certainly the opposite of Tzorat because he means the guy who's always on the move. Wait, look at this, look at this. Joel left before we could get him on camera. Okay, well, we're missing a lot of our regulars this week. It's a shame. And
I can make up
what? But we already got you on camera.
It's the
Shema.
It's the Shema. So I'm not sure. Some of these questions might be a little off base. So if you don't want to answer,
they're hanging around Moshe way too long.
It's horrible. We'll see the impact.
That's what comes of keeping too much of it open mind. You're always playing. That's why it's just
falls right out. Do you remember the buffer?
So much do not want to take myself seriously. I refuse to take my question.
Well, I take questions seriously. I'm just not sure if they're.
You remember the quote? Sure. We had a buffer visiting, and I said, he says, "Your mind can be so open, your brains will fall out." That was.
So we saw the association between the Nachash and Lashon Hara, and we see Abraham in many ways. I'm not sure exactly what words to use as the fulfillment or the next, at least the next stage of development. So I wanted to know if Abraham addresses specifically the Lashon Hara. Is Lashon Hara brought down Adam? So does Abraham deal with?
Too big of a question.
Okay.
That's a good question.
Can I
mean, in the sense of the Talmidav Shel Avraham Avinu versus Talmidav Shel Bilam Rasha, clearly that's the issue there. But it, you know, we need to do more than just bring a mission. I mean, of Avraham's development. We don't.
Right. No, it's a fascinating thing.
Yeah.
The Bilam becomes the Nachash.
Right.
You know, steroid.
Yeah. No, actually, the Zohar has a whole scripture. The Nachash of Bilam, that thing which then ends drawing called Nachash.
What is it with you and grass these days?
You do notice he has been looking a lot happier.
I mean, if I could get some, you know.
Okay, so Shavuot is a kind of a day.
Is a kind of a day, right?
Is that a good assumption? Because we count
it's
seven Shavuot and then
there's
one beyond.
There's two levels of freedom over here. Actually, it was Maki that pointed it out, that you've got one Gemara saying Godol Mila because it's greater than the seventh day. And the other one, it's Godol Mila is because it's greater than the eighth day. And the truth is that it's Kabbalistically, the interrelationship is pointed out as the Shvius versus Yovel. And Yovel is the eighth day. Shvius and Shvuas is only the seventh day. So it's providing you the data, but it hasn't provided you freedom yet. The 50th is the Mitzoy, the 7th, which becomes the expression of Shmini in terms of freedom, in terms of Bina, in terms
and
of actual
dwarf,
knowledge. That's Shemin.
Okay.
All right, I think we're going a bit off field. Okay, one more question.
We talked about a whole bunch of things that are related to femininity. I wanted to ask specifically about relation to femininity over some patient, both necessary and unnecessary, and also offering it.
Brings up some interesting issues.
This guy is serious.
We have to record this. Can we not record?
What? Can we not record?
This Rebbe had a beautiful definition of Dayton Kala that was not the Gnai, in other words, what Chazal really meant, which is Nogeh, what he was just talking about. And it's Nogeh what we're talking about in terms of the Shir. That the Daitin Kalos is that they weren't committed to a vision where a man will kill himself if he's committed to this vision. Whereas the woman will be able to have Das, but she'll forever take in the reality of the moment within that Das because it's Kal, as opposed to a man that is that he, you know, he's committed to being wrong.
I think it's pretty clear that the Rilke pointed this out. The simple weight. I mean, he talked about it in terms of Ibor. I forgot it. The poem was a fabulous poem of the way in which the weight of Ibor makes a woman so pulled down to the earth that nothing can take her out of that. And that's the way that I understood that. Tan Kalot is that always refers to a very specific way of looking at things. And a woman doesn't have that specific way of looking. She's much more mobile in that sense, which is why the Gemara says for a man to move is much more problematic than for a woman. Surprisingly, we usually think about it the other way. Because a woman will always nest wherever it is that she is. It really doesn't matter to her in a deep way. Even as the Gemara says, it doesn't really matter to who she's married. You know, it's just a question of you need to be married. To a man, it makes all the difference in the world. But as far as she's concerned, look, I'm going to make my way in life. You know, I don't really need this guy. But the point is, it's so much nicer. It's so much better. But, you know, I don't really care how we do it. The details don't matter to me anywhere near as much to him. I mean, that's all that he thinks about. Is, you know, it's going to be my way. I did it my way. But to a woman that doesn't speak, I did it my way. Except as feminism in terms of let's be like men. That aspect of feminism. In which, you know, yeah, mehechates, why is that more fulfilling? In the sense of the presence, the power of the presence, which is going to incorporate any type of local vision of reality. There's something that any woman shares with any woman that no man has, that he could share with any man. That's the nature of femininity itself, which is amazing. I mean, you see this in action all the time. You know who brings that beautifully is Alexander McCall Smith. He's absolutely brilliant in terms of the nature of woman and the way in which it's brought. I don't know if you've read his African series, the Sunday Philosophy Club series, the Elizabeth Dowers. It's amazing how profoundly he lives that beauty of femininity, in which the reality is so powerful that, you know, everything else is just bottled to that reality. And I think that very much is b'chol tkufat ha'ibur, like the ultimate tefillah, as the word says. You don't have time to daven Ol Shemoneh Esrei, say the tefillah k'tzara. What is that tefillah k'tzara? And that's the lashon of the Gemara. I forgot to quote it in detail. But that's Perchot Vilata Ibur. Don't tell me I didn't bring it. I'm sorry, I meant Parshat Ibur. No. Did I say Tkufat Ibur? Oh, dear me. No, it's Perchot Parshat Ibur. So the things to do is they recognize that, you know, that Tzorche Amchar Merubim, but at least one thing we should know. Just be with us under any and all circumstances, just like pregnancy. You know, have room in your heart for us. That is very much the female basis of the entire relationship, the tolerance. I forgot to bring that up. Okay, can we close with that? Those are very, very valuable questions, and I'm very grateful to all of you. Anything on the side of the bench?
So the man has to consult with the woman where to live. Okay.
I have. If it's not, then it's not. It looks like it's not.
It's really late. We've gone.